blood vessel growth around the cancer, stimulating vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF. These new blood vessels brought nutrients to the cancer to allow it to keep increasing in size, to fuel its growing biomass. With my troublesome and often swollen knee, I wondered if I had low-grade inflammation throughout my body. Perhaps that's why it was so slow to get better. I had little doubt I had an inflammatory component to my disease, and my gut instinct told me I needed to damp this down. Would a simple anti-inflammatory stop this enzyme? Indeed, aspirin was a COX-2 inhibitor and a vascular endothelial growth factor inhibitor. It seemed like a good idea to me. All I had to do was walk to the pharmacy and get it over the counter. But why was it not mentioned or implemented already by my doctors? How much does my tumor express COX-2? I asked my thoracic surgeon, who was soon to operate on my lung. My goodness, he said in a somewhat condescending tone, you have been doing your homework. Yes, I have. I want to know if you think I could take it, I said, slightly affronted by the implication that it was beyond mere laypeople. He'd forgotten I was a physiotherapist, to investigate these things, let alone attempt to understand them, then muster the sheer audacity to use their special secret language. There's not enough evidence to suggest it's useful, he said. Surely surgery causes inflammation. Wouldn't an anti-inflammatory before and after surgery be useful in that case? I pressed on, not in the slightest bit fazed by his dismissiveness. I had read that tumour markers invariably shot up after surgery. Was this rise caused by inflammation? Or spillage of cancer cells into the blood? Or a dampening of the immune system? Or quite possibly all of these? Well, I would be very worried about stomach bleeds, he added. I don't advise it. It's up to you if you want to take that risk, but if you do take it, I don't want you taking it too close to your surgery, as it makes you bleed more. Fair enough. I wondered if another non-steroidal anti-inflammatory like ibuprofen might be better in the run-up to the surgery, as it wasn't a blood thinner like aspirin. He thought this would also be risky. It seemed illogical. Or was he really saying that anything I tried would be futile anyway? I wondered what the real risk of taking aspirin was. Other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories carried a higher risk of stomach ulcers. As far as I was aware, aspirin seemed to be liberally prescribed for stroke and heart attack prevention. If it was good enough for them, it was good enough for me. I would look up the stats when I got home. I made the decision to take aspirin at low dose despite his negativity, but his words wormed their way into my psyche in a way that would prove catastrophic years later. Indeed, if only I had known the risk with aspirin was a mere 2%, which compared to my 100% risk of dying, would have made it an easy decision. Any improvement in my survival odds was surely a risk worth taking. Besides, keeping the cancer cells circulating would be better than letting them stick to my blood vessel walls and set up camp somewhere new. I continued to probe. Okay, this surgery. I know that right now it's only one tumour, but I'm really worried it might come back sometime in the future and I might have more tumours next time. Have you operated on more than one tumour before?
Oh yes, many, he said with a reassuring smile.
How many have you taken out at one time? I had a macabre curiosity.
Oh, about 20, he said, this with obvious pride.
Crikey, 20. Was there any lung tissue left after that? I wanted to know just how skillful he was. Did the patient survive? I immediately regretted asking this question. I knew the answer before he shook his head. Again, the reality of my situation hit me like a train. I was going to die. If I was going to die, I might as well enjoy myself feeling well while I could. Coughing up blood was a constant source of alarm, but otherwise I really didn't feel ill as such. Tired, but not ill. I knew it was the upcoming barbaric treatments that would mess me up and make me feel terrible, not the tumor itself. I continued my questioning,
putting on my brave I can defeat this face, trying not to stammer with fear or look shaken by this revelation. Andrew and I have just married. Would it be okay if I delayed the operation for a few weeks while we have a honeymoon?
I'm sure that'd be a good idea. Go ahead and I'll book you in for the end of September.
Wow, 5 weeks away. An age, particularly when I only had a mean survival of 12 weeks. Either he didn't give me much hope and thus wanted to grant me one last holiday, or perhaps he genuinely felt I could afford some time to relax. I decided, probably incorrectly, it was the latter. My brain refused to accept he thought my chances were zero. It was all too depressing. In any case, I felt it was important to prepare for the onslaught of surgery. 5 weeks would be time well spent. I was definitely in no rush. As I left the hospital, I'd already decided the conservative approach was not for me. He hadn't given me a straight yes or no about the aspirin, and like all risk-averse doctors, had erred on the cautious side. But sod it. I had stage 4 terminal cancer. My developing theory was that anything that might weaken the tumour had to be a good thing. Attack from every angle. That was my mantra. This was war. No question I was going to take aspirin. The doctors found it easy enough to recommend high-dose chemotherapy. Why was it so hard to recommend humble aspirin if my gut was okay? Was he just blindly accepting what he assumed was my predetermined fate, that any intervention, no matter how small, was ultimately a waste of time? Perhaps he worried about the heavy hand of the General Medical Council coming down on him because of the lack of a randomized clinical trial. The gold standard which ensures no doctor steps out of line. God forbid doctors should try anything innovative like low-dose aspirin to help a dying patient. It was true that we'd just got married, 4 days after discovering the tumour in my lung. I had realised there was no point waiting until my hair grew back to hold our wedding. I had no idea how I might respond to chemo, if indeed I decided to have it. Also, if I was brutally honest with myself, I didn't know how much time I had left on the planet. I had to be realistic as well as positive. Despite my best efforts, I might not be around in 6 months. My feeling was, we may as well go ahead and tie the old knot. Having confirmed that Andrew did still want to marry me, despite this new diagnosis, I followed up with, "How about this Saturday?" I wanted to be married, but I didn't want the distraction of planning it. My dreams of a fairy tale wedding were already shattered, and I kind of needed it out of the way. I had a bigger task ahead that demanded my full attention. I was delighted to hear Andrew respond, "Great idea, let's do it." So, I took it upon myself to organize the event last minute, having only just finished cancelling the arrangements back in Guernsey. I think Andrew was mighty relieved, to be honest. He hates big parties. I love them, and was not relishing the idea of a huge event dominated by my massive family. A quick registry office affair was much more up his street, even though it wasn't mine. "I'll book it then," I said, glad to have something positive to do in the midst of so much depressing news. I phoned the Chelsea registry office, but because it was such a popular venue, and this was August, it was completely booked up. The Fulham registry office was also fully booked that weekend, but after I put the phone down, I ran over there in person and had a little chat with the registrar face to face. After I callously played the terminally ill card, he slotted me in between two other brides who can't have been too chuffed about the wedding assembly line they found themselves on that day. Andrew's only two tasks in the whole event were to, one, turn up, and two, bring a ring. The second half of this extensive list he somehow managed to completely forget. "You do have the ring, don't you?" I asked on the morning, innocently assuming he'd gone shopping as we discussed the day before, while I was having the bronchoscopy. The look on his face was akin to realizing a tarantula was running up his leg, and if he moved the wrong way, he might be dead.
Oh.
Without another word, he turned on his heels and dashed out the door.
He told me later he frightened the life out of the cleaner in the jeweller's, who had yet to open, by bashing on the door so loudly while she was hoovering she thought it was an attempted robbery. Fortunately, he had my engagement ring for size, so quick as a flash the jeweller sorted it out. Andrew came back looking very sheepish, but I was not cross. We laughed. He was understandably a little distracted by recent events. Our wedding day was beautiful. The sun shone. We drank champagne in the garden and were joined by 23 close family and friends, some of whom had flown over from Guernsey. We had cocktails outside in our garden. A case of pink champagne arrived, courtesy of my fabulous Aunt Jane in Guernsey. Then we all walked over the common to the registry office. After the ceremony, we headed off to lunch in a French restaurant in Pimlico. There were tears of joy, problems forgotten, more drinking, at least by everyone but me, and much merriment. A photo was taken that day in 1999. I had the lung tumour, but I really don't think I look unhealthy. I certainly didn't feel it. I bought the dress hurriedly on the Thursday afternoon. My real wedding dress was only half made, and the flowers were chosen the evening before. Amazing how much you can arrange in a couple of days. All this less than a week after my diagnosis of terminal cancer. Did I look weak and defeated? No. In that picture is a strong, determined Jane, and a particularly strong new husband. The evening finally ended in a fabulous Art Deco suite in Claridge's, bigger than most London flats. This had been a complete surprise, arranged by our lovely friends. We thought we were going back home. I felt happy and blessed to have such support and love. What followed was quite some party. We had to nudge people out of the door at 2 a.m. I woke up the following morning a married woman. It felt good. But with the wedding over, it was back to the serious business of research. As every cancer patient soon realizes in this situation, it is an exponential curve of discovery. I was convinced the clues to survival were out there if only I could find them. I could not believe, after all these years of medical and scientific advance, that there weren't drugs or treatments that could destroy my cancer. It was 1999. We flew people to the moon, landed rovers on Mars, connected the world via the internet, built the International Space Station, and we had the spectre of genetically modified food. How and why did we not have a cure for cancer?
Chapter 6. No Stone Unturned. "Good God!" Andrew cried in horror as he picked up a receipt from the health food shop. I'd left it casually, carelessly, on the kitchen surface. "I knew you'd be a high-maintenance wife," he added with a grin.
"I know, sorry," I said sheepishly as he looked through the bill.
"Well, as long as you really need them all and you're not just creating expensive toilet trips," he said, watching me expertly swallow 5 supplements at a time. He was right, of course. How could I be sure they'd do anything? Were they mostly filler? Did they have the correct amount of active ingredient? How much lead, cadmium, arsenic, and other nasties did they contain? Was I just throwing my money straight down the toilet? It was so hard to tell. I bought quality brands I felt we could afford and kept my fingers crossed. Even if I only absorbed a little, it might be enough to tip my body back into health and make the difference between death and survival. Every time I read about some exciting new supplement to target cancer, it went into my cocktail, another addition to my spot of bother chart. What I had failed to learn at this point was that there's a clear distinction between supplements that prevent cancer and supplements that treat it. There is a tipping point in cancer development where some antioxidants, useful for prevention, low oral doses of vitamin C, E, and N-acetylcysteine, also known as NAC, a precursor of glutathione, a master antioxidant, then switch allegiance and support the enemy
helping to promote and fuel its resistance to apoptosis, death.